Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where you are in the world, and welcome to this month's Black Hat webcast, OSX Security, brought to you by Black Hat and United Business Media, LLC. I'm Steve Paul, and I'm your announcer today. We have just a few announcements before we begin. This webcast is designed to be interactive between you and our presenters. Later in the program, we will ask for your feedback. You can participate in our Q&A session by asking questions at any time during the presentation. Just type your question into the Ask a Question text area below the media player, then click the Submit button. We will answer as many questions as time permits. You may also enlarge the slide window at any time by clicking on the Enlarge Slide button located below the presentation window. Slides will advance automatically throughout the event. You can also download a copy of the presentation by clicking on the Download Slide button below the presentation window. And at this time, we recommend you disable your pop-up blockers. If you're experiencing any technical problems, please visit our webcast help guide by clicking on the help link below the video window. In addition, you can contact our technical support helpline, which is also located in the webcast help guide. And now on to the presentation, OSX Security. Moderating today is Jeff Moss, founder of Black Hat. Over to you, Jeff.
Hey, thank you. Hey, welcome, everybody. This is the seventh Black Hat webcast, and we've decided to focus on OSX security. And, you know, the longer we put off this webinar a couple of times because of other breaking topics, and it seems like every time we delay, this more and more stuff happens in the OSX space. Definitely, while not related to OSX security, all the buzz around Apple in the last couple of days has definitely drawn more attention to their products. Especially, they got the new unibody 17 inches, pretty sweet looking. But the overall attention has garnered more inspection, more attention by the security community. And over the years, it reminds me a lot of when XP came out. Everybody thought it was unhackable, and then 3 months later, it was, you know, Swiss cheese. Sort of the same thing's been happening by attrition on OSX, bit by bit. We have two researchers here today, Tiller Beauchamp and Jesse DeGuano, and both of them will be talking about different aspects in OSX security model. First, Tiller's going to talk about retrace, applied reverse engineering on OSX. And then Jesse's going to talk about crafting OSX kernel rootkits, the fundamentals, you know, what he had to overcome, and where the juicy new research areas are that he's paying attention to. And we might speculate a little bit about what might be in store in the Snow Leopard OS rev coming sometime in 2009, as well as taking any questions on any specifics from the audience. So with that, let's introduce Tiller from IOActive. And I'm going to hand it off to him. And during the webinar, I might be interrupting, asking questions, or trying to get clarification. So we don't necessarily have to wait until the very end of the webinar to get your question in. Just put it in the Q&A box, and I'll try to work it in there. And at the end, we'll have some announcements. And if for some reason you have to go or you get bumped off, in a couple of days, you'll be able to download the audio from blackhat.com, or you can pretty much immediately get it from the ON24 site. And we'll have links for all that stuff at the end of the webinar and on the website. So with that, okay, Tiller, let's take Great. It away.
Thank you. So although I'll be talking about retrace at the very end here, the majority of this talk is going to be focused on sort of the OSX security landscape as we've seen it during 2008. So I want to look at some of the more interesting things and try and catch the audience up on events and malware and incidents and vulnerabilities that have developed in 2008. But first, to preface that, let's look quickly at what happened prior to 2008 during. Push the right slide out here.
And this is all. I guess when you're telling us what's happening, maybe specify which OS it was with, because I think different OS revs, you know, definitely changed the security landscape for Apple.
Yeah, certainly. And I'll be talking mostly in general here, but where applicable, I'll mention that.
Okay,
so,
great.
One interesting thing happened back in 2006. Apple moved from the PowerPC architecture onto Intel. So this kind of caught me by surprise, but I wasn't really, like, tied into the Mac rumor scene. So I didn't see it coming, but it had some serious ramifications for security on OS X, because all of the attack techniques and shellcode and principles that were out there that applied to Intel were suddenly much more readily portable to OS X. So whereas before there was this problem of dealing with the power of PC architecture and having to redo things to a certain extent, now a lot of tools and analysis could happen on the Intel architecture on OS X, and the people had the knowledge out there to do it. So shortly after that, unrelated to OS X, HD Moore did this month of browser bugs thing, and it was kind of popular for that year. You saw the month of PHP bugs, and this is a thing where a researcher will release a bug in a certain software package every day for an entire month. In November 2007, we saw the month of kernel bugs by LMH, and 11 of them happened to be from the Apple kernel. And then like a month later, him and Kevin Finister start the month of Apple bugs, and they focus strictly on bugs in OS X. So now it's not all in Apple software. Some of it's in popular packages like the Flip for Mac, but it definitely was primarily in Apple software like Safari or QuickTime. And so in some sense, they're releasing like an OGA every day for a month straight. And they didn't really give Apple any advance notice on this. So it was kind of, you can imagine, irritating for them. They did this in the name of ultimately improving the security on OS X, because they're trying to ignite attention to the area that the operating system really is vulnerable. It's just that people aren't really digging into it yet. And so they wanted to bring attention to that and try and encourage a stronger security posture in the core of the OS. So then, right after that, in the summer of 2007, the iPhone is released, and it's the new shiny hotness, and everybody's dying to dig into it as well. So the iPhone runs a scaled-down version of OS X, which makes it really interesting too, because issues you find in the OS X operating system will also apply to the Safari browser on the iPhone. So there's more portability there. And so a team goes to work figuring out how to jailbreak the iPhone and get it onto different cellular carriers and install your own software and SSH into it, crack the root password and stuff like that. So then Leopard comes out in October 2007, and it includes a number of interesting security enhancements. And Tom from Modisano starts looking at them. And talks about their sandboxing and the encryption, the file vault encryption, and the new firewall. But most interesting is their implementation of address-based layout randomization, or ASLR. So when you combine ASLR with a strong implementation of data execution prevention, you have this really strong technique for preventing classical buffer overflows and heap effect. And so people were very interested to see how effective the implementation was, and it turns out to be pretty minimal, and only the libraries are randomized within the process space. So although this is attempting to prevent the return to Libc-style attack, there's still plenty of opportunity for that, because there's a lot of stuff that's not randomized. So unrelated to the exploit world, we see in October a new Trojan call come out called the RS plug. And it's really unsophisticated. It just, it's a DNS changer, and it requires the user to type in their password, so there's no, exploitation going on here. And then it just changes the DNS server so that, phishing attacks can be launched, and you start getting all these porn pop-ups and so on. So, at the same time, just a month later, the U.S. Army announces that it's going to be integrating Apple computers into its infrastructure in order to sort of fortify itself against attack. And this isn't a new idea for them. In 2005, they announced that they'd be trying to diversify the machines on their network. But in 2007, they announced that Apple's going to be kind of part of that plan. The idea is solid. And maybe I think what they might have done is that they downloaded and installed Metasploit, and they saw that there was, at the time, only one exploit for OS X, right? And then there were, 100 for Windows. And so they're like, gosh, we got to get us some OS X. And so They did, and about 20,000 of their 700,000 machines are Apple-based. But that's still, like, you know, a pretty small portion. That's still less than 3%. So that was an interesting twist. Now,
that seems like a really legitimate way to decide what operating system to acquire.
Yeah, it's interesting. The perceived security that goes along with OSX not being a target, and the real security in terms of its mechanisms. So also in 2008, there's this pwn-to-own competition that happens that kind of pits different operating systems and challenges hackers to try and break into them. And in 07, a couple of researchers, Dino Dizovi and Shane McCauley, won the competition by breaking into OSX on the second day within 9 hours. And so there's different rules that govern what you're allowed to attack and the criteria of the attack for each day. And then day two, they're allowed to do some user interaction. So the stat's mostly interesting when you compare it to 2008 outcome, which I'll mention in a minute. Also, worth noting is the Pony Awards is this humorous award ceremony that happens each year, kind of nominates vendors and bugs for categories like most epic fail and best server-side bug and the lamest vendor response and so on. And so in 07, Apple got two nominations in the category of mass ownage, or one nomination in mass ownage for a QuickTime scripting bug that got utilized by the MySpace. We also saw a nomination in the client-side bug, best client-side bug for this QuickTime Java extension, which I think was the same issue that was shown in the pwn-to-own competition. But they didn't win either nomination. So they also got two in the category of most overhyped bug. So you see a lot of hype around security issues in OSX. But, you know, we're not going to hold that against Apple just because researchers are overhyping their bugs. So that's all pre-2008. For the year of 2008, there was this incredible vulnerability found in the remote Apple desktop that caused this Apple script trojan to be released, this kind of template. So this bug wasn't really from, you know, elite exploit. It was just a bad set UID program that took Apple script from the user and ran it in the context of root, which is, you know, instant privilege escalation. So these guys at the Mac forums, they may have already been developing it, but this ignited, again, efforts on the project. So they released this PHT Apple script trojan, which kind of structured a framework for a lot of the tasks you'd want to do in a trojan, like install a keylogger and, you know, to delete the system logs and prevent logging. It would turn off auto-updating. It was aware of a little program called the Little Snitch, and it would block outgoing network connection. So it would kill off Little Snitch. It would try and crack passwords and make reverse connections back to a dynamic DNS entry to try and connect back to the attacker. So it had a lot of these useful things that are included in Trojan, but it didn't have anything sophisticated in terms of infecting files or hiding itself like a rootkit would. And it didn't have any means of self-propagating. It was just meant to be launched by the user. Right after that, there was another Trojan issue with something called Poker Stealer. Again, this was kind of benign because it required the user to type in their password. It would prompt saying, you know, a corrupt prefaces file has been detected and must be repaired. And then it would take the password in SSH, or it would take the password, enable SSH, and mail the password out to the attacker. So still pretty benign here, right? It's not really using OSX exploits. Okay, so one of the more interesting things that happened in 08 was the introduction of this idea of a blended threat. This is related to the Safari carpet bombing attack. So this is an issue where Nitesh Dejani noticed that the Safari browser would, when it got a file from a website that it didn't know what to do with, it would just save it straight to the downloads folder. So he saw this as a security issue and reported it to Apple. And you can understand why, right? This will let a malicious website just push a whole bunch of malware into the download folder with names like, you know, Paris Hilton and exgirlfriend.jpg and love letter and all these other crafted, clever ideas that would spark the curiosity of the user into double-clicking on this malicious content. So Apple responded saying, you know, thank you very much, but they didn't really see it as a security issue, but they were going to file it as an enhancement request, and then, you know, it might take a while. So this has interesting implications, more so on Windows, because the default download directory is actually the user's desktop. So the desktop has a much higher visibility, and so you can litter the desktop with tons of icons of malware and so on. But that's actually not where the Blinmit threat comes from. The Blinmit threat is a combination with a bug in Internet Explorer. So it's long been known that Internet Explorer will automatically load certain DLL files off of the user's desktop as it starts, as long as the DLL has a specific name. So another researcher combined these two things and showed that, you know, there's a DLL, there's a callback in DLL files called DLL main that gets called when the process starts or the library is loaded. So if you put your malicious code in there, then Safari or IE will launch and execute that code. So by combining this automatic pushing of files onto the desktop and automatic loading from IE, you get this blended threat scenario that's pretty interesting. So that also ends up winning a Pony Award for one of the categories, I think best client-side bug, and QuickTime gets another one, but again, Apple doesn't take home a winner. Also at Black Hat in 08, we saw an interesting thing. Apple pulled a talk that the engineering department was planning on giving. So we see some miscoordination issues between Apple internally, their engineering group and their marketing group, and you can kind of see who's winning that competition. That engineering wants to do this talk and reach out to the community and say, hey, these are our security practices inside the company, and we really do care about security, and this is how. And so this was supposed to be a panel discussion, and then PR got a hold of it and was like, no way. So you see that again and again in their marketing. Like, there was another issue that just happened with this antivirus recommendation that caused a little media storm as well, where an old article on the Apple site was updated with some new information, and this old article recommended the use of multiple antivirus clients. And so the media was like, hey, wait a minute, this is like totally contradictory to all the advertising campaign that says, you know, OS X is immune to viruses. And does this imply that Apple is changing their posture and should be worrying all this stuff? And it turns out that it was an old article, and Apple pulled it down and says that, you know, they're applicated, that OS X is well secure and doesn't have to worry about viruses. And so if you go on their get a Mac fact, for transitioning to Mac, you'll see this wonderful quote. It says, quote, Mac OS X resists most viruses, so you can do anything without worrying about losing everything, unquote. And so, in some sense, that's actually true, right? Because most viruses are written for Windows, not OS X. So they're kind of getting away with something for free there.
A little wordsmithing on that.
Yeah, and it makes sense to the average user, because they don't necessarily know that, you know, a Windows program can't naturally run on OS X.
Right.
But to all of us that are security experts, it sounds very absurd because there's no inherent protection in the operating system that's preventing someone from writing a virus that works on OS X.
It's like the fire extinguisher that puts out most fires, but they won't tell you which ones.
Yeah. Okay, so that's kind of like some of the high points of 2008. We also saw Charlie Miller get some more attention for his reputation of hacking the iPhone in there. But so let's look at some zero-day statistics. Now, Tipping Point has this interesting program called the Zero-Day Initiative, where they buy vulnerabilities from researchers, and then they handle the whole responsible disclosure process with the vendor. And then they reward the researcher with money, and they incorporate the vulnerability into their intrusion detection system product so that their customers can be protected while the patch is being built by the vendor. So this is really a good thing because it puts a structure around this responsible disclosure process, right? And it also rewards the researcher in the process of doing that. So we can look at some of the results of that program and see that in 2007, there were 6 bulletins that were related to Apple. And in 2008, there was a strong increase. There was actually, I put 16 here, but it's actually 17 Apple-related bulletins in 2008. But most of those were related to QuickTime, but there's some other issues, I think, with Cubs and 2 Safari issues. So there's also 6 currently unpatched Apple issues that range in age from 400 days to 90 days old. So, of course, the one that's 400 days old is probably something Apple doesn't consider important, right? Maybe they decide not to patch that, but there's 6 open issues going into 2009 here. So that's out of 88 total, and kind of on par with the amount that you see from Microsoft. Now, this is all interesting, but we have to remember that this doesn't necessarily imply anything about an increase or a decrease in security in OS X. It just means that more people are participating in the program. But it's still an interesting statistic to look at. A much more thorough treatment of this subject was given by some Swiss researchers at Black Hat Europe. And they looked at the patch windows related to discovery of a vulnerability, disclosure of a vulnerability, and the patch. Okay, so they measured these periods of windows, which they associated with black risk and gray risk and white risk, and they summed up, they come up with a bunch of summaries about different vendors. And so the real takeaway from that study is that we're seeing the number of unpatched vulnerabilities that affect Apple increase and continue to increase. And I think we're going to continue to see that grow. What it kind of implies is that we're getting more incoming vulnerabilities affecting Apple than the Apple team is able to keep up with. So let's talk a little bit about Apple's best security features is actually their market penetration. So if you look at the desktop market, you know, I think you're talking about 9% market penetration in this area. So that makes, from the security perspective, it makes OS X kind of a small target, right? If you're a malware writer, you want the biggest bang for your buck. And so you're going to invest your hard time in building something that's going to recruit the most number of nodes into your botnet. And the most number of nodes out there are still Windows systems. So, and that's what people are still focusing on. You see the difference between the perceived security that OS X gets and the real security that it actually has. So it's still benefiting that from that, though. But we just have to hope, meanwhile, that somebody doesn't decide to write a virus for OS X, because it might happen. And if it does, let's just, you know, hope it's not massive and it doesn't get all our iPhones and all our MacBooks. So if we look at some of the patches that have come out from Apple, we see that 35 bulletins were released this year. That's on par with last year. I mean, when I say this year, I mean 2008. They released 38 bulletins in 2007. But there's no correlation there between the actual number of vulnerabilities in each bulletin that get a patch. And I tried to count them all, but I started to bleed, so I had to stop. But the gist there is that you see patches for Apple-specific software like Safari, both on the Windows architecture, because they deploy a QuickTime and Safari for Windows, but also on OS X. Another interesting problem they have is they package a lot of open source software into their operating system, and so they have to also take responsibility for updating those packaged versions and pushing them out to their customers. And that's interesting because they don't necessarily have like the strongest control over the development of those projects or the SDL that gets the secure development lifecycle principles that get applied to those projects. And they may have some criteria, right, for accepting and deciding what packages are okay to send out to their customers. And so maybe that's something that they could have talked about in that last Apple pack at Black Hat to kind of give us a better idea of how they handle this whole patching process. They also have the challenge of the iPhone, right? So sometimes certain researchers have pointed out that a Safari patch will make it onto OS X, but then it doesn't get pushed out to iPhone on time either. So you have this problem of a patch out there, which can be reversed, and then a person can turn it into an exploit pretty quickly. And then although the patch is available for OS X, the iPhone version is still vulnerable. So I'm sure this is something they're addressing, but that was a risk that came up at least once. So if we consider all this and we look at kind of the stage that OS X is at in terms of its security mitigations and where Windows is at, we see a very different maturity here that correlates with the size of the target, right? So Windows is trying hard to tackle this problem of kernel protection and signing drivers, and they're building in these integrity checks and experimenting with patch guard and trying to prevent things like malware from even being able to load into the kernel. And so this creates problems for their vendors and antivirus, and we've seen those media frenzies as well. And whereas in OS X, there's a completely different focus. I mean, you can just have a root user land program that writes straight into kernel memory. There's no, you don't even need to write a kernel driver. So they're kind of a very different stage here. OS X is still, they just did this ASLR thing, and they need a better, stronger implementation there, and I'm sure we're going to get it probably with the next release of Snow Leopard, but it shows a different focus on these targets, which correlate with kind of the risk involved.
Well, how much of this, though, do you think is just maturity? I mean, you can't jump directly to the SDL that Microsoft's been deploying for 5 years.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a reason, right? There's a number. There's in 2001 and the early 2000s, we saw a number of really awful viruses hit Windows, worms like Code Red, that were just devastating. And Windows, they didn't really have a choice. They had to say security from now on is going to be a very high priority, and they invested a lot of money and time into that. So you're exactly right. The maturity level here reflects the environment that they've had to deal with.
And Charlie Miller, who's on the call, also just dropped a Q&A response on. He just wanted to remind everybody that sometimes things get patched on the iPhone before OS X.
Ah, good point. Yeah, it might have already happened, but the iPhone market penetration might be even stronger than OS X. So that would make sense. It would be important to patch the larger target, right? So let's look at some of the research we've seen in the past. Way back in 2005, Ichimura did this article in an Uninformed Journal about PowerPC shellcode tricks. So he talked about the differences between writing shellcode for Intel and the PowerPC. So I mentioned that Intel PowerPC switch, but people were still looking at PowerPC back in 2005. So he talks about the instruction cache and how that kind of messes up some of the things that you're used to doing on Intel. And then from NeMo, we saw a number of interesting and really informative papers come out. He did this one on OS X heap exploitation techniques, where he talks about the specific implementation of the heap on OS X and the different zones that relate to the size of the allocations. There's a tiny zone and a small zone and a large zone. And then there's these kind of metadata structures that point to the functions for a particular zone. So by allocating a ton of memory, you could eventually allocate those function pointers at the end and then trigger a function call. And then you have an effective code execution technique. This is no longer applicable in the current version of a Leopard, but it's still good background. He also did abusing mock OS X, in which he takes a look at the kernel architecture and talks about the BSD side of things and the power of the mock API and how it handles message passing between and communication between processes. There's this whole IPC architecture, and if you can connect to a process's port, then you can do anything like write its memory or catch exceptions or whatever. So he explores what's possible with that, and kind of in the context of his Weapons X rootkit. We saw this fiasco with the device drivers talk and exploiting Apple's Wi-Fi drivers by David Mayer and Johnny Cash at Black Hat 06. Then we saw in track 64, this talk on Xing Yu Hope. So this is another thing by Nebo, and he starts out with sort of techniques for non-executable stack bypass, and then he kind of proceeds to write a small book about a number of other interesting security issues, including binary infection of files and rootkit techniques and kernel exploitation, a bunch of other stuff there too as well. And then Charlie Miller, you mentioned he did a Hacking Leopard Tools and Techniques talk, which was very interesting. It looked at some of the tools that were particular to Leopard, and it's a great place to look if you're interested in getting started in this area, but you don't want to jump like straight into heap exploitation techniques, right? So he talks about some of the tools for tracing, detrace, and she shows a port of PyMay File Fuzzer, which is a Windows-based application. So he wrote a little library to interface with the mock API, and then he's able to fuzz files using this framework, which is actually really strong. I don't think he releases to public, though, but it was definitely cool. So then after the media storm calms over, David Maynard does his talk on an article on exploiting wireless device drivers on OSX in the Unfarmed Journal. There was also another paper, non-executable stack loving on Mac OS X86, by KF. I forgot to put on a list there, but Nemo references it in one of his articles. There's also, I want to mention the OpenRCE reverse engineering community portal. It's very strongly Windows-based, but they are open to OS X questions and work. So moving on to some of the specific stuff we've seen this year, the iPhone dev team definitely did their CCC, definitely did their talk on what's new in that area. So they're talking about jailbreaking the 3G version of the iPhone, and so they did that at CCC 25 just like a month or two ago. We also saw some work from Cameron Hotchkiss called Under the iHood. And this was interesting because he took a look at what's unique about Objective-C when it comes to reverse engineering. So Objective-C is this version of C that Apple uses a lot that follows a really different paradigm. It's not calling functions, right? It's using this message passing. So there's objects and events, and you send events to objects rather than calling functions. And so when you're looking at this from the disassembly perspective, it looks like the same dispatch method is always getting called over and over again. And you have to actually look at the function, the parameters to the function to figure out what's going on there. So he wrote a little script that plugs into IDA that can be used to help with that process. We also saw Jesse here. He's going to talk, I won't spoil the surprise, but he's got some cool stuff to say about OS X rootkits and the mock API. And then David Wesson and I did some work on building frameworks for vulnerability analysis using dtrace and the mock API and trying to combine some ideas, so I'll talk in more detail about that in a second. But in general, we're still seeing like kind of a small proportion of talks for OS X that specifically target security issues on OS X. But we are seeing an increase in the treatment of OS X topics in general security talks. So, for instance, Nate McPeters, Rob McCarter, and Billy Rios did this talk on sort of the scary implications of all the URI handlers that get installed in browsers. So this is a general attack vector, and they do include treatment of Safari's URI handlers that are installed there. So we're seeing some more of that. All right, so let me review some of the work that I did. This is just going to be really quick. So last year in push out the right slide here. So starting in the beginning of 2008, David Wesson and I looked at taking dtrace, which Charlie Miller had mentioned earlier, and seeing what we could accomplish with it in terms of vulnerability analysis and exploitation. So we did things like, first let me give you a quick background. Dtrace is a dynamic tracing tool that was introduced by Sun and Apple ported it to Leopard. So, tracing utilities aren't new, but dtrace has a really flexible framework, so you can write scripts that measure particular metrics in the application. So it's much more than just function call tracing. You can do conditional call tracing and get kind of a broad view of an application. So you can say something like, tell me the top 10 modules that get called in this during this run of this application. Or tell me something very specific, like on the when this printf function is called and the parameter is a specific value, then I want to halt the application and attach debugger so I can do some analysis. So you can get very broad answers answered, or you can answer very specific questions. So we looked at using that to do things like writing a Stack Overflow detector, writing a Heap Overflow detector, doing some code coverage tracing. So we can highlight all of the blocks in IDA that get called during a particular run of an application. But DTrace is limited because of its goal on safety. So it has a preference to do the safe thing rather than be thorough in its analysis. So you do run into that sometimes, and we found ourselves wanting more functionality, like the ability to search through and modify memory of a process. So what we did was write C bindings on the mock API so that from Ruby we could access the mock API and do things like set three breakpoints and handle exceptions and search and change memory. And then we combined several other libraries other people had done, like IDA Rube, which interfaces with IDA over the network to access its API, or MetaASM, which is also another disassembly engine. And there's a Ruby package for DTrace. So from the Ruby environment, we can do things like set callback functions. We can define a Ruby function that gets called when a particular breakpoint is hit in an application. So this can be a really interesting and useful tool for doing automated sort of exploit pinpointing or exploit analysis. So there's plenty of information about all this that we've thrown out there over the last year. It's on the articles are on the Blockhat site and such, so or you could check it out on Pop-Up Red. So one of the applications that I'm interested in using this framework for is this idea of vulnerability classification. So Scape did a paper recently on Unknown Farm describing or introducing this idea of exploit properties, in which he says, okay, let's scope our security efforts to portions of the application based on properties about either the particular function or the particular process or the features, security features on this platform. So he uses these as criteria to scope the work, whether it's the attacker's work or the defender's work. So kind of using that same idea, you can try and use heuristics to profile a vulnerability and collect information about a vulnerability as it's triggered, and then turn this into a rating, like an exploitability rating for that vulnerability. So this would be really interesting for the application of patch prioritization, because vendors are going to be swamped with security issues, right? And they need to figure out what's the highest risk issue, because we need to figure that out. We need to patch that immediately. The tool has some applications in that area. You can check it out. The tool is up on popoprite.org. So let me look a little bit at the future of OS X. So we mentioned Snow Leopard's coming out soon. I expect to see some pretty serious implementation there. Some new security issues. Also, there's a new book coming out by Charlie Miller and Dino Dizovi, so I'm excited to check that out. And there's the XSO mailing list from Cameron Hotchkiss. So if you're interested, you can join that or check out OpenRCE. So that's about what I got.
Do you have you been hearing anything about Snow Leopard, or is that all in the traditional Apple sense, really hush hush, and nobody's got a secret peek?
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to take a look at it. I think there might be some beta versions out there, but I haven't had that opportunity yet.
I've got a question for you. It's more of a sort of a speculation question, but with the additional SLR type functionality, they're wondering how speed consuming are they? Will it make Mac OS X slower, comma, like Vista?
No, I mean, there's not really a performance issue there. What's happening is that things are being randomized at the point that the application starts. So this isn't like as the application continues to run, things change in place, right? It's just an initial remapping of instructions inside the application space as the application starts. And so there's going to be, Apple may decide to do something, some sort of some mitigation to handle that. Like we've seen them randomize applications across, on each operating system, but multiple indications of that process are not randomized. So this means that the attacker cannot write a worm that targets both unless they find some generic method, but that the process doesn't have this performance issue.
I was remembering that I'm a big FreeBSD user, and some of the FreeBSD code is used in OS X. And when you compile in some stack smashing protection, you take about a 2.5% performance hit. But it's so immeasurable with today's processors.
Yeah, that's true. And the problem of stack protections is completely different because when you're doing that, you're inserting a stack canary, and then that canary needs to be checked after the function return. And so there's more logic that has to happen inside the workings of the program.
We've got a question for you from Sean at internetnews.com, and he's wondering that you've talked about your tool in the past at previous conferences, and are you continuing to develop your tool? What's going to be new in your tool for 2009?
So, you know, it's one of those things where as time allows, I get to work on it, and we all know how that goes, right? The time is taken up by the other job issues, but I'm really looking at one of the things that needs to happen is the tool is kind of in a proof of concept phase, so it needs to be made much more robust in order for people to use it from for a wide range of tasks. So, I mean, there's the general boring stuff like that, making it more usable and providing more documentation.
But fundamentally, is there a giant new leap forward in functionality, or is it just refining and make it more reliable?
My goal will be to explore this idea of building heuristics to characterize the exploit, right? And this is a dangerous thing to play around with because anytime you try and say, oh, I've decided that the vulnerability is, you know, unlikely exploitable or it's not exploitable, we always see vendors say that kind of thing and then they get burned because someone comes out with an exploit for it. So this isn't going to be meant to be the ultimate analysis tool, but it can provide some insight and that's necessary for patch prioritization.
Matt, over at EI is wondering if you're going to release the tool.
Yeah, it's on pop-up right now.
And can you spell that?
pop.rep.org.
Excellent. All right, and we'll have more questions for Tiller after Jesse gets done, and then we'll be able to ask them both questions at the same time. So we're going to pass it over. I want to introduce Jesse DiGuano. Let's get his slide up on the screen and let Jesse talk about crafting OS X kernel rootkits. And I think this is a refinement or a shortened kind of refinement of what you did in Vegas last year.
Yeah.
Take it away.
All right. So I'm Jesse DiGuano. I'm with Praetorian Global. As Jeff said, I presented on crafting OS X rootkits at Black Hat 2008 USA. Since we're kind of limited on time for the webcast, it's not the entire presentation, but there were a number of cool things that I didn't get to go into much detail with, kind of ran out of time during my presentation, so I'm going to kind of focus on that. But first, I'll go over a little bit of background just on the OS X kernel and some of the rootkit techniques that can be applied to OS X. The OS X kernel, also called XNU, you may be familiar with some of the different press points about OS X, especially when it first was released, that it's based on FreeBSD, and it's also based on Mach. And you may be more familiar with BSD than on Mach, but Mach is actually, it was a microkernel that was developed originally by Carnegie Mellon. And the difference between a microkernel and a traditional monolithic kernel that we see in most modern operating systems is that microkernel actually separates many of the tasks that usually reside within the kernel address space, like memory management and process management, file systems, drivers, and actually runs them as servers inside the user space, as opposed to a monolithic kernel where all of those things, those traditional things, run within kernel space. Just a little breakdown of some of the things that are in this marriage between mock and BSD within the XNU kernel, some of the things that are handled by the different subsets of the kernel. So we see we have security and access control. If we're familiar with BSD security, traditional BSD security, that's handled by, for the most part, by the BSD portion of the kernel, as well as the POSIX API for interoperability, networking, process management, file systems, the crypto subsystem. Those kind of things are all handled by the BSD portion of the kernel. Whereas mock actually handles things like kernel threading, interrupts, kernel debugging, IPC, the actual interface with the hardware, memory management, and things like that. So, like most modern operating systems, the Mac OS X kernel, XNU, can be extended dynamically. So you can introduce code into the kernel with kernel extensions or kex within the Mac operating system. It's really very similar to in Linux. Linux is loadable kernel modules for drivers, file systems, other things that you can dynamically add or remove from a running kernel. Or FreeBSD's KLDs, also kernel objects. And really this is needed and necessary for a modern operating system which can run on a plethora of different types of hardware. You don't want to compile support for everything into the actual kernel, so you need some way of loading and unloading code depending on the particular platform it's running on. So, like I said, I'm not going to go into huge detail on some of the typical or common rootkit techniques that are available through kernel extensions, but it can be kind of, it's somewhat obvious that kernel extensions run within kernel space. And so you have access, your code is running within the kernel and can modify kernel memory and add code or functionality to the kernel. So some of the common techniques from a rootkit writing perspective that we may take advantage of using kernel extensions is hooking, so hooking system calls to subvert the read system call, the write system call, get dir entries, other types of system calls. Hooking network protocols so that we can execute some desired code based on some network trigger. And also direct kernel object manipulation. That name was first coined as far as rootkit development on the Windows side. But really this just means directly manipulating in-memory structures that are within the kernel's memory. So structures that are used for record keeping and housekeeping within the kernel, as opposed to going through some documented APIs for modifying those structures, we're directly modifying that memory. And this can help us to hide things like the typical purpose for a rootkit would be to hide live processes, hide network ports that are listening, actually hiding kernel modules that are loaded, and other things. So instead of just killing a process in order to have it removed from that the kernel structure that keeps track of live processes, we just remove the entry from that structure. So those are some of the things that are available through kernel extensions. But there is a case for wanting to modify kernel memory without actually loading a kernel module or a kex. So as we talked about, the most obvious way to modify kernel data structures, introduce code into the kernel, do hooking, is through kex. And really, this is the only supported way of introducing code into the running kernel. But there is definitely a case, especially when hacking a machine, for not wanting to load a kernel module into the running kernel. First of all, a smaller footprint. And from an anti-forensics perspective, if we need to load an actual kernel extension, put it on the file system, load it through the mechanisms for loading a kernel extension into the kernel, there's much more record keeping and a trail that shows what we did. And also, if we can do something from user land as opposed to loading it into through a kernel extension, we can also incorporate our techniques, our rootkit techniques, to hide our traces through shellcode. So if we've compromised a given process and we have access to, say, a process that's running as a privileged user or a root, writing to kernel memory or instrumenting our rootkit techniques through that mechanism definitely has a lot of benefit. So kernel memory patching, actually modifying memory from user land, from the role of the user, without going through the traditional ways of introducing code into the kernel. There's a history on most BSDs of actually modifying kernel memory or process memory through the devkmm and devmem pseudo devices on the dev file system, and then also using libkvm, which is an access library to allow us to interact with kernel memory and modify address space within the kernel. So this is a pretty straightforward way on most BSDs. You'll see BSD and Linux rootkits that install themselves without using kernel modules use something similar to this approach. Unfortunately, on OS X, the devkmm device is not available. Apple removed this device from being installed by default from any Intel machine starting with 10.4. And also on modern versions of OS X, we also don't see libkvm installed either. So in order to directly manipulate kernel memory, we can restore the devkmm device, and there's actually instructions or a guide for how to do that. Amit Singh has a guide for how to install a new devkmm device on his website there. And then we'd also have to install on the system libkvm. But obviously, if we've just compromised a host, we don't want to have to be installing packages and restoring device nodes in order to hide our tracks, because it kind of defeats the purpose of not installing things and leaving a smaller footprint. So this is where the beauty of this marriage between mock and BSD really comes to play, because as opposed to just using traditional BSD approaches for introducing rootkit techniques and modifying kernel memory, we also have the mock API. So this mock API really gives us a nice, clean API for directly modifying the memory of any other mock task on the system. So if you have permissions to write to from one mock task to another mock task, you can use this mock API to actually directly write to the memory of another process. And we see that the kernel, the running kernel under OS X, is actually just another mock task. So if we have compromised or we're running as root, then we can write directly through the mock API to the kernel's memory. And obviously, if we can write to the kernel's memory or to any task's memory, we can do pretty much anything. The game is over. That's the whole idea behind most exploits that perform some sort of memory corruption or give the attacker control over another process's memory space. So some of the useful mock functions that we find is task for PID, which will easily allow us to obtain a handle for the mock task that is identified by the process identifier. VM write, which allows us to write to any arbitrary address within the target's address space. VM read, which allows us to read from any address from the in the target's address space. So really with the combination of even just those three functions, we're pretty well set. We can completely modify the running kernel because and its memory space because we can write to any arbitrary address within the kernel's address space. The man pages for detailed instructions on how to use these functions are found in the kernel source under osfmk/man for those mock APIs. So utilizing this particular, the mock API calls, we can do much the same techniques that we have available through loadable kernel extensions. We can perform hooking. We can hook system calls or network protocol handlers. We can do direct kernel object manipulation. We can modify the running process list to remove our process of our, say, running Trojan or backdoor. We can remove records of listening ports, again, that any record of our listening backdoor. We can also do inline function patching, so we could really change the control flow of the running kernel by substituting code within the running kernel's memory. Now, actually patching code, substituting or rewriting code within memory, installing new code, usually requires allocating new memory because we don't want to just write our replacement code over whatever else is in memory wherever we're writing to. This tends to have bad results, especially when running in kernel space. So there are several ways to allocate new memory from within kernel space or code that's running within kernel space. This is usually done by a kernel extension. If a kernel extension has the need to allocate new kernel memory, there are several macros available, like the malloc macro that you see there. Or via the IO kit, there are also IO malloc and some other related functions in order to do just that, to allocate new memory within the kernel space. But again, that is that code needs to be running in kernel space and traditionally through a kernel extension. This is really the same with BSDs. So a free BSD rootkit would have the same kind of problem. But if we are trying to modify or allocate new memory from user land, within the kernel's memory space, this is kind of an approach that has been taken in the past with FreeBSD or BSD rootkits in order to do just that. And it's really first you would identify the address of some system call handler like make directory or something, and you would back up the code that exists under that system call and overwrite the actual code for that system call with the kmalloc code that you want to execute in order to allocate new memory. And then you would execute that system call, so perform a make directory system call or whatever system call you've overwritten, and it now actually executes the code for kmalloc to allocate new memory, and then restore the original code and go on, and you've got newly allocated memory from within kernel code. Obviously, this is somewhat convoluted and complex, and it's also problematic because you have an inherent race condition that if that particular system call that you just overwrote is executed by anything else on the system before it's restored to its original code, you're going to have problems. And again, when you have problems in the kernel, you generally result in a kernel panic. So this can be very, very dangerous, especially if it's on a system that's widely used. Well, with the mock API, it makes it really easy. So in order to allocate new memory in any other mock task, there's VM allocate. and we can specify the mock task and how much memory we want, and it will return an address or a pointer in that mock task for where our new memory has been allocated. So it really, on OS X, allocating memory within the kernel from user space has become much more easy. So I went over some of the different techniques that we can do with by abusing mock from a rootkit perspective. This is actually a pretty cool little thing. I didn't come up with this. This was Nemo actually first discovered this. But if for those of you who are familiar with the BSD security system, there are different syscontrols, particularly secure level, that is used to restrict certain actions, even by root. So if the syscontrol or the secure level syscontrol is set to anything above zero, for instance, certain restrictions are placed on even on the root user from changing flags on files, etc. And here we see a little demonstration of changing the root user can change the syscontrol level or the secure level from 0 to 1, or can increase the secure level, but the root user can't decrease the secure level. And this is kind of inherent. Without rebooting the system, even the root user can't just decrement or decrease the secure level, because that would kind of defeat the purpose. Well, utilizing mock techniques to write directly to kernel memory, we can very easily find the address within the mock kernel of secure level, and use VMwrite in order to write directly to kernel memory any value we want to the secure level placeholder or variable syscontrol.
As root, though.
Yeah, as root.
Yeah.
So as root, but generally on a BSD machine, even as root, you cannot decrement the secure level without rebooting the machine.
Yeah, I wonder what happens if I rebuild with my VM kernel drivers missing. I'm just thinking on FreeBSD how you can compile a lot of the VM memory management stuff.
Right.
Yeah, but you won't have that option on OS X. You can't tweak anything.
Right. Well, on BSD, with particularly, like, for instance, with secure level set, generally, you can't write directly to, like, devmem, devkmem. That's one of the restrictions that's put in place by the secure level flag within the kernel.
Right, right. And does Apple management differ significantly from what you would find on BSDs, the way they handle secure levels, or is it all basically just cut and paste?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Since you have this marriage between mock and BSD, they've inherited, whether it's conscientiously or not, some of the inherent protections or controls that would generally be within a BSD system. But because you have also the mock system running side by side, you can bypass some of those, like the secure level.
Okay. So let's see. I've got a question. This can go to either one of you, Jesse or Tiller, on what kinds of protections exist to protect against overflows besides DEP and ASLR? Does OS X implement stack cookies or any other protections that might be comparable to Windows? This is from Rob over at E&Y.
So, actually, you don't see stack canaries on OS X. It's one of the few operating systems that doesn't have that implementation. But their debugging tools do have settings where you can do heap overflow tracking. So the support's in there as sort of a memory leak testing functionality. And we may see that in the future get morphed into a security feature. Currently, no, though.
And are there any, I remember on the XP days, there was Skype had written a tool, what was it called? For Windows that provided ASLR and some protections before Microsoft included it. Yeah, are there any third-party packages that try to enhance any of this stuff? I mean, is there...
I haven't seen any. No, I mean,
yeah.
There's really just DEP and ASLR. You know, you don't have the safe SEH exception handler that's unique to the Windows architecture. So,
and there's no third party security team, you know, porting any security apps or some way to execute only signed code, or you know, you sort of have this rich arcology of different security products in the BSD world.
I haven't seen anything publicly advertised, but I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we saw that the U.S. Army is adapting OSX. I wouldn't be surprised if they've done their own customizations in order to really lock down and harden their OSX deployments.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe privately that sort of stuff is going on.
Could you please repeat the website address for the IRK?
Oh, for the IRK rootkit?
Yeah.
It actually, the rootkit is not actually released right now. I will be doing that actually probably later this month, but it's not actually released. If you go to PraetorianG.net, which is our website, /presentations/IRK.htm, it should be up there.
Okay. Would using mock override or mock inject decrease any of the potential problems when using these techniques? From Chris.
I'm not really familiar with mock override, so.
Okay, so Chris, if you can maybe clarify your question, I'll ask it again. Are there any ways of disabling DEP on OS X?
Well, there's a VM protect call you can use to try and disable DEP. One of the problems with that is that the call requires the task ID, which you might not necessarily know ahead of time. So there's that challenge, but I mean, you might be able to find in the process, or just, you know, I think you can use -1 to just indicate the current task. So that was mentioned, turning off DEP that way was mentioned in that OSX stack bypass loving on x86 talk. So you want to go take a look at that by KF's paper.
So is it generally reasonable to expect you can or can't?
There's actually, you don't need to disable DEP because you can actually trampoline off libraries that aren't randomized.
Okay.
And then you can execute on the stack. So, you know, it's that problem of, like, you have two systems, and if they're both not strong, then you lose.
Right. You play one off against the other.
Yeah.
This is a speculation question. Will we ever see a widespread OSX worm?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because one of the requirements of a worm, well, maybe not, so the attack vector for worms has changed. If you look at OSX, or if you look at what happened to Windows, it was in a time when personal firewalls were not as common, and you had a lot more systems sitting there directly facing the Internet. So it was really prime for that kind of remote, wormable service vulnerability. And now we see a completely different architecture where everything sits behind native devices, and the vendors have spent a lot of time securing the remote services, but there's still this rich world of vulnerabilities within web browsers. So I think if there's going to be a worm, it's going to be something that's more web-based, like that MySpace worm that exploits client-side software, you know, through a large social networking network.
Would you agree with that?
Oh, myself?
Tiller, yeah, and Jesse.
I would agree with Tiller. I think, too, it really depends on kind of what we see in the future as far as market penetration. You know, that's really, like Tiller brought out, the perceived security of OS X has always been just that. There's always been issues with just as many I would say, issues with the OS X operating system as with other operating systems, but it's perceived as more secure because it's not as well targeted. And the Microsoft family of operating systems was kind of, in the right place at the right time as far as being the poster child for, widespread worms. But if we see a lot of market share going over to OS X, or with the iPhones, et cetera, then I would say it's completely viable that a widespread worm could affect OS X.
Here's a question from Vincento over at Zynamics, one of my favorite companies. Are there any mock rootkit samples in the wild as far as you know?
Nemo did WeaponX.
Right. If you're mock rootkits or just OS X rootkits, I guess I would have to clarify.
Yeah, the question was just mock rootkit samples.
Right. So primarily utilizing the mock API from userland, I haven't seen any. The only other kernel mode rootkit that I've seen was WeaponX, and it was a pretty close port of another rootkit, a BSD rootkit, and it was a loadable kernel module that primarily took advantage of system call hooking in order to cloak itself and do its magic.
There was also a Synar, Synar did a rootkit that was BSD based, and he talked about its applicability to OS X, and also about, interestingly, evading D-trace detection. So that, I'm not sure, like he said it works on OS X, but I haven't seen it actually run, so that's worth looking at. The Synar rootkit, I think he did a talk on it at a CCC conference.
Okay, we've got a clarification from Chris. Would using mock inject or mock override make exploitation of mock processes easier or less unstable than using DCOM or writing your own code on top of VM read and VM write?
I would say possibly. Upon a little bit further investigation, go Google, it looks like mock override and mock inject, really, they're kind of, it looks like they're more like wrappers around some of the mock API. So to use mock in order to inject into process space. So possibly, I'm not familiar with that particular API or what that the functionality of those wrappers. So it may make it easier, but the vanilla mock API is pretty easy to use from that standpoint.
Yeah, so I wonder if Chris there is talking about doing a return to C-lib style attack and calling these functions in order to set up your shellcode in particular memory segment.
Possibly. That may be the case. And definitely using mock for attacking other mock tasks, not just the kernel, is definitely a viable attack approach from user space or from shellcode as well in order to infect other processes or jump into other processes. So, the functionality of that particular mock override or mock inject, again, I'm not personally really too familiar with.
Well, that feeds into the next question, which is, Jesse, do you study, Mac OS X kernels by analyzing the BSD docs and source and the mock documentation? What other sources of information do you use?
BSD doc, the actual the source code that is available for the OS X kernel, reverse engineering. So IDA is your friend. GDB, remote kernel debugging, is also your friend as far as those kind of inspecting the OS X kernel. You also, with the kernel development kit, it comes with a symbol pack that can allow you to resolve symbols that aren't defined within the kernel that comes on Mac OS X. So that can help to decipher what different structures actually are doing and what they're doing. But a lot of just runtime tracing and reverse engineering and reading source code and And then just also documentation around BSD kernel development, because really it does come, a lot of the code is directly ported from the BSD kernel. So a lot of code that you for developing an actual rootkit, if the source code for instance, a particular structure is not available, along with examining it in memory, looking at the BSD equivalent usually gives a lot of information.
Let's see. Can third-party applications currently opt into the ASLR?
I think it's just because it's a lighter version of an ASLR implementation, it's just randomizing the library. So, yeah, I mean, everybody's kind of in it.
So shared libraries would be already randomized, but the actual code is not being...
Okay.
If that makes sense.
The base location of the library.
It's not like on Microsoft you can opt into DEP sometimes or opt out.
That's right. And, you know, that brings up a point I forgot to mention, was that these security mitigations are really low-level. So by applying strong ASLR and applying strong DEP, you're usually going to break valid software, you know, like Java or something that's complex, Flash, because they require the ability to do certain things that blocker ASLR will prevent. So that's why Microsoft has these opt-in and opt-out policies where the protections become optional. And so that's a challenge. That's a definite challenge for the vendors finding solutions for that.
Okay, let's see. We're running out of questions. And I want to remind everybody that before you go, we've got a survey. We'd like to get your feedback so we can improve these webinars in the future. And also, we take your questions and your topic suggestions, and we go and we find speakers to cover them. So if you've got something you'd like to see in a future webinar, feel free to provide feedback, and we'll see if we can make it happen for you. Okay, we'd like to have the IRK URL on PraetorianG.net repeated, please.
Okay. It's going to be praetoriang.net/presentations/IRK.htm. And it's not up there right now, but it should be up there soon.
Like today or this week?
Yeah.
Or?
I'll make sure it gets up there today.
Are there any known rootkit scanners for Mac OS X? That also plays into another question, which is, as the market share is rising and malware is expected to increase, are there any suggestions that you guys know of for, say, antivirus or anti-malware? And what about Intego?
Yeah, I think, Apple pulled down that security bulletin in which they recommended three different vendors, Norton, I think there's a Secure Mac or Mac Scan.
There's a Secure Mac one that Freaky develops. I know that.
And then the Intego one, too. So, yeah, those are all out there. And
do you have an opinion on any of them, or is it more like...
I'm not personally...
Yeah, so you guys don't run them or play with any of them.
Yeah, I'm not personally familiar with the benefits or drawbacks of one over the other. So, and then as far as rootkit scanners, I have seen... there have been a couple of projects floating out there, I think mostly like open source projects that run on Mac, either a collection of Perl scripts or this or that are supposed to be to scan for rootkits. But they're at least anything that I've seen do not look for rootkits. Don't look for anything, any kind of kernel rootkit. They are simply looking for user mode, replace binaries and things like that.
So here's another question from Matt at EI. Is heap spraying possible for Safari?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So heap spraying is a technique where to defeat address space randomization, you don't exactly know where your shellcode is going to be. So you can't jump right to it. So what you do is you put it everywhere, and then you
fill your memory with shellcode.
Yeah, so you usually this happens where you're trying to, you basically spam your shellcode all over the heap space and then jump into a random spot hoping that you're going to hit a slide into your shellcode.
Right.
Okay, we're down to the last couple of questions. Not a question, but a comment. This article goes into great depth explaining how OSX applications can avoid having DTrace attached to them. Oh, and then he provides a link so long I can't.
Yeah.
If I guess you Google for Leopard PT deny attach, and you'll find the article.
So that's an interesting, that's actually DTrace a blog post.
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
So Apple they kind of accidentally crippled DTrace in their implementation by preventing you from tracing important applications like iTunes, probably, I'm guessing, because of DRM issues, right? So this had the side effect of ruining certain metrics. So if you're trying to trace all applications across the system, you're expecting to get probed at certain intervals, you're going to miss one when the iTunes application is running. So one of the inventors of DTrace discovered this one day and pointed it out and was not happy about it. And the next day, Landon Fuller, he has a blog post about a kernel module that you can load up to turn off this PT attach deny check so you can DTrace and attach debuggers to these processes.
All right. Well, I'd like to let everybody know that to send us feedback about this is through email. If you choose that route, it's feedback@blackhat.com. And other than that, I think we're out of questions, and we're pretty much running out of time. And so I want to thank everybody for participating today for all the questions, and I want to thank Tiller and Jesse for taking the time to share their information with us. So with that said, I'm going to pass it back to the conference moderator.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you all for attending today's Black Hat webcast, OS X Security, brought to you by Black Hat and United Business Media, LLC. Shortly after this live event, you can access this presentation on demand. This webcast is copyright 2009 by United Business Media, LLC. Presentation materials are owned by or copyright, if that is the case, by Black Hat and United Business Media, LLC, who are solely responsible for its content, and the individual speakers are solely responsible for their content and their opinions. On behalf of our guests, Jeff Moss of Black Hat, Tiller Beauchamp of IO Active, and Jesse Daguano from Pretorial Global, thanks for your time, and have a great day.